linguistic art chicks.
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. This is Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. We've got an interesting program today with two of our old friends, Timothy Leary and Robert Anton Wilson. And I'll tell you more about the short talks I'm going to play in just a minute. But first, I want to thank two of our fellow saloners who sent in donations this past week. And they are Mark S. and Robert O. So thank you very much, Mark and Robert. What can I say? If you're new to the salon, by the way, you might not have heard me mention Robert before, but he's been with us since the beginning, and what's more, he's, like me, he's a grandfather, and I have a special affinity for grandfathers these days. And my guess is that, also like me, being a grandfather is probably one of the high points of his life. So, Robert and Mark, hey, thanks again for your help. It means a lot to me. So, what's on store here in the salon today? Well, thanks to Dennis Berry and Bruce Damer and quite a few volunteers who digitized this material, we have some more talks from the Timothy Leary archives. As I've gradually been working my way through all of the files that they sent, I've come across a number of short segments that were recorded in several different settings, and so I thought it might be interesting to get some of these bits and pieces out into the light of day. So the first bit I'm going to play is from a tape that was labeled Timothy Leary and Michael Benner, 5793, recorded at Leary's home in L.A. Now, I'm not going to play this entire conversation because much of it was political speculation and wishful thinking about what the Clinton administration would bring. And we know how poorly that turned out. Poor Tim's faith in the Clintons was certainly misplaced. But there are a few parts that provide an interesting perspective on how significantly life in the West has changed since the time of Tim Leary's birth. He was 72 years old at the time of this interview, and looking back, I'd say those were 72 years of gut-wrenching change, sort of like the times we're now entering into once again. So let's listen to this first little segment, and then I'll be back to tell you about some of the other little gems I found.
It's 1993, Tim. Where are we with LSD in 1993?
Well, LSD has been a factor, I would say a significant factor, in incredible social and cultural changes that have taken place in the last 20 or 30 years. So it's kind of hard to talk about LSD without talking about the context of tremendous cultural revolution and social change that we've all been going through. And when you talk about Millennium Madness, this change is going to accelerate in the next 7 years as we zoom towards the 21st century. And there is now, as you know, a so-called resurgence of LSD. I never believe anything I read in the paper about anything, particularly about personal lives and drugs. But I spent a lot of time in college campuses, and there's no question that the new generation of college students who are taking LSD thoughtfully, quietly, planfully, and I don't want to use the word seriously.
Not too seriously, anyway.
You'll scold me.
Right.
But with an attitude of spiritual ambition and of celebration and, yes, we'll throw in a little pagan Dionysian stuff here, but
spiritual ambition.
Yeah.
What a wonderful phrase.
And I don't know if this is relevant here, but I don't want to legalize drugs. It's not the government's business to legalize anything that we do privately in our homes, adults. Are they going to legalize masturbation? Are they going to, of course...
Or your vegetable garden.
Yeah, right. They could. Yeah. I know that if the right-wingers really took over, they would legalize only face-to-face lovemaking with your eyes closed in the dark in the missionary position. So it's none of their business. So I don't want the government to legalize anything I do that has to do with my own private domestic life. I must say, though, that all politics starts in the home. And the number one, here, you want Millennium Madness ranting? I'll rant for you here.
Rant to me,
all right,
please.
Here I go.
I was hoping you would.
We'll shove in the rant button. Here we go. Buckle your seatbelt, yeah. By far the number one problem facing our species for the last 25,000 years has been the relentless, ruthless, perennial, almost invisible oppression of women and children by armed men. And it starts in the home. You know, every 13 minutes or 13 seconds, a woman is beaten up by someone that they know, not to mention the abuse of children, so that when you get right down to it, it starts in the home and then the neighborhood. I'm 72 years old. I went through the 20s. I belong to the first generation that was ever called a generation. Until the 1920s, they didn't talk about generations. You can live for 100 or 1,000 years and there's no kids coming along doing something different. The concept of a generation implies that young people are doing something different.
Change.
Yeah, and in the 20s, there was an incredible empowerment of young people. It's all based on McLuhan. McLuhan said, the medium is the message, the medium creates the reality, the medium creates the species, really. And I belong to the first generation of human beings who, as children, in their own home, could listen to radio and could listen to events happening hundreds of thousands of miles away. Also, I was the first generation of kids that grew up where there was a telephone in the home. I'm talking about the average phone. What that means is that my generation is a heroic generation. That's why we got so involved. I can remember when I was 12 years old listening to Benny Goodman playing from the starlight roof at the Hotel Pennsylvania in downtown New York. Boy, did that snore. Or Tommy Dorsey in the Palladium in Sunset Hollywood. No, boy. And then I heard Franklin Roosevelt talk about, we have nothing to fear but yourself. And I remember sitting with my mother listening to translations of Hitler. I could hear Hitler's voice announcing, what he was planning. So that is following McLuhan. My generation is a new species. We were the first globally hooked up species. That's why we were so involved in World War II. That's why after World War II, my generation was the first conquering group in history that instead of looting and raping and exploiting and occupying the defeated countries, we turned around like good social workers. We fought by Benjamin Spock. We helped them out. Germany, they're screwed up kids. Oh, those naughty Japanese. Well, then we'll help them out, give them our self-respect. And all of our, the first time in history that the victors went all out to try I'm proud of my generation, and also proud of my generation because with Dr. Spock as our biblical prophet, we did something that had never been done in world history. We were taught by Spock, treat your kids as individuals. So then the next generation, they're called the baby boomers, they grew up in the 50s, and they're a magical generation and a heroic generation because they were the first generation of human beings that grew up during they call it the Chomsky window. You learn languages between 3 and 12 with television. And that's why, we're at Harvard doing our LSD research. We would talk about having a psychedelic session. We didn't use the word turn on and tune in. That came from the street. That came from the kids because they were the first generation that could dial and tune and
turn on this alternative reality.
Yeah. That also leads to again, each of these generations, my generation and the so-called hippie generation, were heroic. We were thrown into the future where there were no maps, there was no guidebooks. And I'm proud to say that my generation, right now, they're pretty nasty, senile, grabbing. The worst thing in the world, you want is government health care. Can you think of that? Is that an oxymoron? I mean, the ultimate insanity. You want politicians to be in charge of your care. But anyway, but the hippie generation was, again, a wonderful generation thrown out there in the future. Peace and love and stop the war in Vietnam and the various... So humanism.
And a belief that we really could make the world a better place.
Well, they did.
It is a better place.
Yeah. cause a lot of trouble, because as soon as you get people free, then a lot of people don't know how to handle freedom, but still. And now, of course, people are putting the hippie generation, they were not very literate. They could spell M-I-C-K-Y-M-O-U-S-E, but it's not known.
Only if we sang it, we could get a head start.
Yeah. The hippie generation is not known for great writers, and they tend to become passive, and they also know-it-all. Look back. The hippies, to be honest, were not very hip compared to, say, the beatniks. And now we got this new generation coming along of the children of the baby boomers. I don't know what you want to call them, Generation X. I spend most of my time now with kids under the age of 29. They're teaching me. They're training me how to use these new languages. And again, they've been thrown into another incredibly confusing future. The first generation of Americans, kids that knew they were never going to have the money that their parents had, probably could never have a house. They've had to face the collapse of all the solidities, religious and political. And if you look at it that way, as we move towards the millennium, I think all of us should try to kind of look at the last 80 years we've been through and celebrate. It is madness. It's madness because it's unpredictable, unknown. Dr. Spock was a Boy Scout. I mean, Captain Kirk, they were puddling around with little baby stuff compared with what our three generations have gone through. And I'm going to urge anyone who listens to this invitation about the Money of Madness thing. If you're older, if you're in your, I'm 70, if you're 60 or 50, come on down and let's celebrate the three generations of Americans who have really heroically, and not knowing, that's the whole point. You didn't know what we were doing. Now you can kind of look back and realize what was going on. Let's make this Money of Madness thing a reunion, a coming together of the three generations instead of a... It is true, the older people now are trying to grab all the money, and the younger kids don't have... They're all overqualified and underemployed, and the baby boomers are becoming kind of, settled in. But I propose this Millennium Madness be an incredible celebration. We survived.
Yeah, that's a reason to celebrate.
80 years that...
we are survivors. Let me ask you one final question. The 60s seemed to be, if they were about one thing, about love. Peace and love, the peace and love generation. As I have grown older, and you're sharing your age, I'll share my age. I'm 45, graduated from high school in 66, and college in 70.
Good year.
Right there, okay. As I've gotten older and evolved, talk host, journalist, somebody still looking for answers and understanding, I know that that heart part, the love and the peace, is still very important. I don't mean to diminish it at all. But I've also come to understand the importance of more choices, creativity, imagination, vision. And I look at computers, and I know you're interested in computers too, and I remember something Bucky Fuller once said about we have all the right technology, but for all the wrong reasons. And I'm wondering...
This is incredible hardware, but there's no software to humanize it.
Or the wetware up here.
Well, yeah, the wetware is there. We have to learn how to operate it.
That's the question I'm asking. What are the right reasons to use computers? Where are we headed in the year 2000? What are we supposed to do with these machines? What can we do as we learn to see them as extensions of our central nervous system to empower us to have more choices and more answers? What are we going to do with them?
Well, this is my viewpoint. I'm going to energetically and as passionately as I can articulate it in the next few years. The function of the 21st century is to learn how to operate our brains. We do not know how to operate our brains. We do not know how to turn them on or turn them off or to dial, left brain, right brain. We know a little bit about it, but we're going to be able to use multimedia, electronic... appliances to communicate, to create new languages that are not just verbal and just English or Japanese. It's going to be the very concept, when I say you must learn how to operate your brain, that concept is very new. I never heard anyone say that before three or four or five years ago. Operate your brain. We're not supposed to operate your brain. You don't operate your heart, you don't operate your liver, but the human brain is designed to design realities. And, of course, none of the educational or religious or political institutions want you to know that your job in life is to learn how to operate your brain and do that kind of and change everything.
To invent your life and make it up as you go along, basically.
Yeah.
To design it, as you say.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the encouraging...
So we have to go from seeing ourselves as victims or a fact to taking responsibility for our lives. That's a major attitude shift. That's a 180.
Thank you. Oh, yeah, that's been my motto for the last month. Don't become a victim. The number one industry in America today are all these victim industries.
Right.
You can't name an orifice of the body or a problem. They don't have a foundation or a government grant. And those politicians and administrators and bureaucrats, they're trying to make us all victims. Every politician, of course, and all these new illnesses they're inventing. And every day you see some doctors found that cholesterol is good. No, it's bad. White sugar is good. No, it's bad. They're trying to make us feel victimized. Don't be a victim. Be smart, be alert, be shrewd. Avoid trouble. Street smarts. I'm not saying just wander around loving and believing or anything, but I'm glad you brought that up because it you triggered that off.
I think that's baseline. That's very fundamental.
Yeah.
Kind of a concept. Well, listen, thanks for being available. Millennium Madness is coming up. Let's get the dates and the times here. Saturday, May 29th. At the Scottish Rite. Your friend Bob Wilson's going to be there.
Good pal.
Jack Herer, who wrote The Emperor Wears No Clothes. Paul Krasner.
Krasner and I go way, way back. He's one of the funniest guys around.
The original Yippies and one of my favorite troublemakers.
Yep.
Roy of Hollywood. You know Roy of Church.
I do, yeah. And I want to repeat again, this is going to be a great celebration. And invite your parents, if you're 18 years old, invite your hippie parents. And if you're in the 40s, invite your, invite the grandparents. Because instead of quarreling with each other, or, you know, we should all glorify that the three of us, three generations of, we've led the world. It happened here because of communication, and it's a very, very positive message, which I think is going to... get the new millennium going. Get it going to a good start.
Timothy Leary, thank you very much.
Good.
Before we move on to other thoughts, I would like to return for just a minute and say something about what Dr. Leary just said about what he considers to be the biggest threat to our species. Here's what he said. By far, the number one problem facing our species for the last 25,000 years has been the relentless, ruthless, perennial, and almost invisible oppression of women and children by armed men. And it starts in the home. And I am in complete agreement with him on that point. But while it seems obvious that any child who is raised in a family where spousal abuse takes place is going to be emotionally scarred for life, but there are other, less obvious ways that we cause emotional and mental harm to our children. I saw one example when I was at the gym the other day and watched a very stern-faced father half drag a crying, barefoot little boy behind him. The child couldn't have been much over three, and he obviously didn't want to be left in the child care room while his father worked out. And I heard his father yelling at him that men don't cry and that it was time for him to start growing up. Well, with a role model like that, it isn't hard to figure out what kind of a father that little boy will grow up and become. But an example that is closer to home is the way I often acted. Like many other misled fathers, I thought that if I worked like a madman for most of the year, it would be worth it if our family could take a spectacular summer vacation. And we did. And they are still among my children's most treasured memories. But what I regret is coming home way too many nights just completely exhausted. And all I wanted to do was to have a drink and be left alone. I hadn't seen my wife and children since morning, and now I tried to tune them out in the evenings. Now, I don't mean to imply that it was like that every night, but it happened often enough to still be a clear memory for me. Although I try to avoid looking back and playing the what-if game, I can't deny the fact that I would give a lot just to have one of those evenings back again. And yes, my little lecture here is intentional because I know that there are a lot, and I mean a lot, of fellow saloners who have children of all ages, And I happen to think that nothing is more important, nothing is more important to the future of our species than our children, grandchildren, and the greats, if you're so fortunate to live that long. They are the future. And as hard as it may be on some days, above everything else you do each day, the half hour of one-on-one time with them will probably do more for the world than anything else you can do. Okay, no more lectures today. As you might have guessed, besides the fact that there was a lot of really good information in those few brief sound bites, I had another reason to play it as well, and that is I want to point out what mainstream America was like as recently as 1993. At that time, most of the people in this land still actually believed in the USA being the good guy and not looting other countries, with the exception of the Vietnam vets and their families, of course. We understood. But as it is becoming so painfully clear right now, that little bit of American lore was quite far from the truth. After all, with only around 5% of the world's population, we consume over 30% of its resources. And now we discover that the gnomes behind the curtain are the Wall Street and international bankers, the financial wheelers and dealers. But don't worry, I'm not going anywhere with this. I just thought it's interesting to see how much and how quickly public opinion can change. Oh, and one more thing. For the record, I am not a member of the baby boom generation. I reported aboard at the tail end of the generation Tim Leary was in. And to save you looking it up on my website, I was born in 1942, just a few months before the first nuclear chain reaction and the discovery of LSD. And although I may be what my children sometimes call a dusty old fart, I'm still young on the inside, just like you, my friend, just like you. And now, I'd like to play part of another tape from the Tim Leary archive that is dated just 2 days after the Leary interview that we listened to. And it is another Michael Brenner interview, but this time with Robert Anton Wilson. And it more or less picks up where the conversation with Timothy Leary ended. So let's join Michael Brenner and Robert Anton Wilson now and see what's on their minds.
Live from somewhere in Northern California. I know where, but I'm not telling. Robert Anton Wilson. Bob, good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to talk to you again. It's been a while since we've chatted. And, you know, I was thinking this morning, probably the hardest part of this interview is introducing you. I know you as an author, of course, but you're such a subversive, a rascal, a scoundrel, a troublemaker. I'm not sure how else to introduce you. Could you introduce...
Ontologist.
A what?
Guerrilla ontologist.
That'll do. I want to thank you for getting up early. I suspect you did on this Sunday morning. And Millennium Madness is an event that's coming up here in Los Angeles on Saturday, May 29th. And I know Tim Leary's going to be there, and Paul Krasner, Jack Herer, and of course you. One of the parts of this event, this Millennium Madness event, is the Cosmic Conspiracy Game, which I understand you wrote and have a lot of experience playing. Can you tell us a little about that? What is the Cosmic Conspiracy Game?
Well, the Cosmic Conspiracy Game is a lot of fun. Every time I've organized one, everybody has agreed they had a lot of fun. But it's also teaching a great deal about the way we make assumptions. Everybody in the game is lying and knows everybody else is lying, but still people fall into all sorts of traps, and it teaches you how to be more aware of how uncritical our thinking generally is and how most of the reality we experience is based on our own uncritical thinking, our assumptions that we project outward and perceive as part of reality.
Boy, this, you have no way of knowing this, but this dovetails perfectly with the conversation that we were just having here about victims. I'm getting so frustrated dealing with victims, people who call the show, Bob, and say, you know, my life is not working. I'm not having any fun. It sucks. But, of course, I have nothing to do with it.
Yeah, well, being a victim is very popular these days. As a matter of fact, it's been popular for 2,000 years.
Is it getting worse? Are we more a victim than before?
Well, we got more reasons to explain it now. In Christianity, you were a victim because God is inscrutable and we all have original sin anyway because Eve ate the apple, so let's blame the women. But now we got all sorts of other, maybe it's our genes. Maybe it's our Oedipus complex. Maybe it's our conditioned reflexes. Maybe it's the social system is structured wrong. Maybe it's the damn bankers. So we got all sorts of reasons to feel victimized. Besides, we all belong to a minority. 220% of the population belongs to at least one minority.
So if it serves us to say I'm being oppressed because I'm in this minority, we often do that.
Well, yeah, and it's easy enough to prove. For instance, I'm a white male. Everybody is down on us. But we're actually a minority, so we got a right to organize and fight for our rights and call ourselves victims. We're an exploited minority.
I wonder if
only a minority it's respectable to despise.
I wonder if technology, the fact that it's sort of faceless and monolithic and what am I saying? That we don't really understand technology anymore. We're using all these technical goodies and we don't really, aside from knowing how to put the battery in or plug it into the wall, we've really got no idea what's going on inside. Do you think that could to exacerbate this problem of feeling like a target or a victim or an effect of life?
Yeah, absolutely. People remain ignorant and then they feel that the environment is hostile because they don't know how to deal with it. I am happy to say my daughters are both excellent automobile mechanics. They never feel victimized by garages because they usually fix their own cars. If they can't, they take it to somebody they know they can trust because they've watched him and they see he's not cheating. If people learn how to handle technology, they're not victims anymore.
You know, Robert, I read your book, The Cosmic Trigger, about 9 or 10 years ago as I was backpacking through the Sierras and on a solo backpack trip. It was one of those I really want to get away, and I'm taking the Cosmic Trigger with me. What a trip that was to read it in that context, that situation. And something from that book that's occurring to me now as we talk about this is that passage about, and again, it's been a decade, so you might have to help me out, that passage about discovering that even though looking at like a Playboy a fold-out, a Playboy centerfold or a Hustler magazine picture of naked women, that arouses men. In other words, their perception of even a picture of a woman, and you talk about using a magnifying glass and seeing, my God, it's just dots of ink on a page, and yet here the physical body gets aroused as if it were a real woman out there. What was the conclusion to that? What was that proving or illustrating?
It's my variation of the old Buddhist parable about the guy who sees the snake and drops dead of a heart attack. Another guy comes along and sees a rope and walks right over it. The Buddha comes along and sees energy that his mind is organizing into a rope. It's true. We're all subject to the same psychological laws. I get turned on by sexy photos myself. But I know they're only photos. That's relatively benign, in spite of the fact that both feminists and Christian fundamentalists find it appalling. It's relatively harmless to be aroused by a photograph. But people are aroused by words and ideas that are just as symbolic. And sometimes words and ideas will drive them to commit murder. Sometimes it'll drive them to mass suicide.
I guess it's the power of imagination that I'm looking for here. The idea that, as we were talking about earlier on the show here this morning, that reality is really more a function of perception than anything objective.
Yeah, reality is the temporary resultant of the perpetual struggle between rival gangs of people who think they can define reality for everybody else.
Well, it's hard enough just to define it for ourselves.
But getting back to the news photos, I didn't think that one up. That was pointed out by a friend of mine named Malaclips the Younger, the omnibenevolent polyfather of virginity and gold, and high priest of the head temple of the Discordian Society. If you take the sexiest photo and use high enough magnification and stare at the part that you find most exciting, it dissolves into a bunch of dots. That's really a mystical experience. You're practically a Buddha at that moment when you realize you're being turned on by your own imagination and a few minimal clues provided by the photographer.
Increasingly, I have felt that even though my 60s values about peace and love still I still feel strongly about those as values. Increasingly, I'm seeing that the direction in which I'm evolving also has a lot to do with supplementing peace and love with critical thinking, with more choices, with creativity, and not stopping with that one right answer, but again, recognizing that imagination is a very creative process in a very real way. I mean, it's not just fantasy or illusion that we're talking about when we talk about imagination.
Yeah, well, peace and love is, I'm all for them, but if you don't have a critical intelligence, you're going to be victimized over and over until you lose all your peace and love and turn very bitter and probably become a paranoid. There's an old Sufi story about a Sufi who taught a snake not to kill. And he came back a year later, and the snake was all beat up and really a terrible, a tragic case. And he said, "What happened?" And the snake told him, "I became nonviolent." And the Sufi said, "Wait a minute, I told you not to kill. I didn't tell you not to hiss."
Ah. That's very nice. This Millennium Madness 93, coming up May 29th at the Scottish Rite, is apparently the first of a series of annual events that will sort of count down the 90s as we approach this new millennium, the third millennium, the 21st century. Are you more of a optimist or a pessimist? How do you control your pessimism? And what do you think about this next 7 years as we approach the year 2000? There's such incredible change happening.
My big hope is that in 2001 we'll find that black monolith and we'll get close enough to find on the bottom of it, it says Rosebud.
Is that what the crop circles are?
The crop circles will eventually spell out the word Rosebud.
Rosebud.
I avoid pessimism by the simple fact I find so many things to do. The only people who have the real leisure to be pessimists are people who have given up and don't do anything. And they can sit around and concentrate all day on how miserable they are and how hopeless the world is. But if you keep busy doing things, you don't have time to be a pessimist.
I asked your friend Timothy Leary once a few years back if he was optimistic, and he looked at me like I was crazy. And he said, "Well, yeah, but what choice do I have?"
Exactly. who starts? Who wins? Who passes exams? People optimistic enough to think that they are smart enough to memorize the data. Who gets jobs? People who think they're attractive and smart enough to win the interview game. Who gets the best sex partners? Those who are optimistic enough to think they're very attractive. The pessimists lose all the time. It's very fashionable to be a pessimist, in literary circles especially, but they never tell you if you really make a consistent career out of being a pessimist, you're going to be a loser all the time. Who wants that kind of life?
Well, hooray for that. Who wants to be a pessimistic loser all their life? And dear Bob Wilson was anything but pessimistic right up to the end, I'm told. As you know, some corporation made me take two of Wilson's podcasts down already. But I've been looking around, and hopefully we'll come up with some more public domain recordings of the wit and wisdom of Robert Anton Wilson. I know a lot of you are looking for it, and we'll get it out there as soon as we can find some. And now, at the risk of sounding like one of those Ginsu knife commercials where they keep saying, "But wait, there's more." Well, I would like to say, "But wait, there's more." Now I'm going to play the first 20 minutes or so of a talk that Dr. Leary gave at Cornell University on April 23rd, 1984. And I guess I'd better give what might be called a spoiler alert. If you're a member of almost any religion, you are most likely going to be offended by some of what Tim has to say to this young audience, particularly if you're a Christian. So you may want to just skip the rest of this podcast rather than get mad at someone whose opinion on religion wasn't, very friendly. So you've been warned. Now, Dr. Leary.
Good evening. My name is Chris Langone. I'm president of the Cornell Civil Liberties Union, and I'd like to welcome you all to tonight's speaking event. The Cornell Civil Liberties Union meets on Tuesdays in Loft 2 of Willard Straight Hall. We were the first student chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, and we were founded 27 years ago. We serve the campus community in many ways. We publish a newspaper on liberty, which I see many of you are reading. We've helped with rallies, the March 4th pro-choice rally, and we're currently campaigning to prevent the reinstatement of the death penalty in the state of New York. We're also working on a community bill of rights for all members of the Cornell community. Another thing the Cornell Civil Liberties Union does is it brings speakers to campus to talk about civil liberties issues in many different aspects. Last year, we brought up Jello Biafra, lead singer of the Dead Kennedys, who spoke on censorship and rock music. And just last week, we brought up Bobby Seale to help commemorate the takeover of Willard Strait Hall. Tonight's speaker, the most dangerous man in the world, Dr. Timothy Leary.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be back at Cornell. It's always been a favorite hangout campus of mine. In the 60s, you had that theme song, High Above Cayuga's Water, is that it? You were the envy of the rest of the country. Thomas Pynchon comes from this campus, who is my number one most valuable poet of the century. I think it's a real honor for me to be here at the invitation of the ACLU chapter, and it's a wonderful tribute to your university that the first campus ACLU chapter was formed here. So how about a round of applause for ACLU? I'd like to start by paying tribute to a man who played a great part in the events that brought us all together here tonight, a man who will go down in history as certainly a legend. I'm talking, of course, about Abbie Hoffman. I think Bobby Seale was here last week, probably told you, that about 3 weeks ago, Abbie and Bobby and I came together in Nashville, Tennessee, Vanderbilt University, for a little reunion. And at that time, it was very shocking to me to see that Abbie was in physical and psychological, he was pretty wounded. Abbie was a manic depressive, and when he was in manic gear, he invented rap. I mean, he laid down smoke tracks. You clocked him at RPM, that's revelations per minute, and he was smoking. But on this occasion, Abbie was pretty almost unresponsive, which was, if you knew Abbie, you've seen him. He was just the energy capital of the world. Until he got to the microphone, and to Abbie, of course, the microphone was the golden lotus flower of desire. And when they waved that mic in front of him, suddenly he pulled himself together, and he laid down the most powerful, logical, driving, spellbinding lecture, speech, oration I've ever heard him give. And at the end he said, we may have been young, and we may have been silly, and we may have been idealistic, and we may have been too romantic, but God damn it, we were right. And everybody, even at a conservative school like Vanderbilt, oh yeah, right. Of course, Abbie was one of a large group, a team of many men and women, and really millions of young men and women in the 60s and 70s who stood up and stopped the most powerful government in the world from a foreign war in Vietnam, who shook up this country by basically returning to individualism and giving pride to minority groups and giving pride to tremendous effect upon the male-female relationship. I was watching the news tonight. I was really delighted and amazed at the spirit of Abbie Hoffman and that period, although it's been very quiescent on this campus and in America for the last 8 years of the Reagan, Rambo, Ollie North regime. That spirit of the students of the 60s and 70s was on the nightly news. Did you see the students in China Can you believe it? Maoist China, which is the most locked down, uptight dictatorship in world history, and there were 100,000 students out in the last 3 or 4 days. I mean, that, and that's playing for the heavy blue chips, you know. You don't fuck around with a regime like that unless you... boy, I got a thrill. And of all places, in Moscow, Red Square, just yesterday, again, a large crowd, 20,000, and you saw the faces. My God, they were like the faces of the 60s, young, glowing, inflamed with some passion for freedom in the Soviet Union, I mean. Now, guess where they learned that, huh? Guess where they caught on to that? Guess where this notion of youth power and student power freedom and civil liberties, you know, right here in Cornell 20 years ago, and I was very proud, and I think Abby Hoffman would be proud to have seen that. Of course, Abby was not the, as I said, the only one in the last few weeks. I've seen Bobby Seale in San Francisco. It was a wonderful group of people like Ken Kesey and Augustus Stanley Owsley. I understand his son is in the room here. Hope to see you later, Starfire. Grateful Dead. I could go on listing the people that kept the spirit going in the 60s. Now, I was asked by Chris, the chairman of the ACLU group, to kind of stir people up a little here tonight. People a little too apathetic. Abby used to say, the campuses are seething with rest. So I'll be glad to oblige. It is. I'm not going to give you a sermon. I'm not going to give you a Sunday night locker room pep talk about going out there and winning one for the yipper. I'm going to perform philosophy. Now, that may be a little surprise when I combine that verb and that noun. Philosophy in the past has not been performed. In the industrial society, where everyone has their little pigeonhole and their little duty to perform, philosophy is taught by professional philosophers, just like their professional accountants in ivory towers. In feudal societies, in feudal organizations, in feudal countries, which, by the way, are still a majority in the world today, I would say perhaps 60% of the people living on this planet today live in societies which are basically feudal. You know, it comes down from God. Philosophy is not taught. Philosophy is enforced. You know, the Ayatollah Khomeini claims to have 1 billion followers of the Islamic persuasion who will gladly go out and perform an assassination for him. The function of a performing philosopher is not to try to sell you on any brand name of philosophy. I have no dogma. I have no favorite cause here. I have one cause, and that's the goal of a performing philosopher, is to encourage you and inspire you and empower you, to the extent I can, to think for yourself and question authority. Now, the way I'm going to try to do that tonight is I'm going to try to... It's all the language. We are, as the French semioticians tell us, we're enshackled by our language. We're imprisoned by our language, by ideas. And so what I'm going to try to do is to, with as much clarity as I can summon here, and zap on and to laser and to warm up and to buzz and to tickle and to stimulate the shackles of language that are tying you to any particular religion or any particular political party, even to question your enslaving commitments to your country and God knows possibly even to your gene pool and possibly even to your parents. Now, in other words, if I don't make fun of any of your favorite deeply held convictions, yeah, you call me back during question and answer period and you can get your money back. Now, as I make fun of these sacred cows, let me make this point, because I hope to kick some ass here tonight. But they don't know any better. See, there's no anger here. They don't know. I'm talking literally, rationally. They don't know any better. The Ayatollah Khomeini, he just doesn't know any better than to try to get a billion Islamic people to go out and kill this fellow that wrote a little silly book about a hallucination he had about his sacred Allah. I mean, guy has no sense of humor. And to the extent anyone follows him, they don't sense of humor. By the other hand, he's doing the best he can, and it's our job not to attack or in any way get down to that level, but to use the information power that we have now to gently get people to disidentify with that. Now, it is true that if you should take on this role of urging people to think for themselves and question authority, y'all can get in trouble that way. And that's part of the game, you know. Most people, see, don't want to change. Most people are doing the best they can. They've been entrapped by their parents and their language and by the language of their society. They don't, you know, and they're discouraged from thinking for yourself. That's the key. How many of us in our growing years were encouraged to think for ourselves and question authority and come out with new ideas? You know, the aim of the game until Dr. Spock came along in 1946, which created the 60s, by the way. Dr. Spock was the first person that told parents, hey, your job is to teach your kids to be individuals and to encourage your kids to be individuals and to treat your kids as individuals. Oh, Jesus. When he said that, that's the most subversive statement you can make. Talk about anarchy. Forget it. When you teach kids to be individuals, you're undercutting every religion and every organization and every political dogmatic system throughout the world history. No matter whether you're left, right, Christian, Jewish, Mormon, name it, everybody who had an organization agreed you had to take kids and get them to line the kids who are little wogs, little animals. You got to get them with a carrot and a whip. You got to get them to conform and join the pack. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to remind you about the three stages that we have gone through as human beings and that you have gone through as individuals, and show how your ability to think for yourself has been limited in each of these, and why at this moment in world history, as we leave the industrial society and move on to the post-industrial society, it's not only your pleasure to think for yourself, it's your duty. You got to think for yourself in the information age. Now, let me remind you that in the past, as I suggested, it has been very perilous if you tried to think for yourself. We're told that human society started 25,000 years ago in a tribal society. In a tribal society, you were not encouraged to think for yourself. All of the thinking was done by a man, naturally with a man, with a big long beard, the head of the, he was a shepherd, and he had that big crook. You know what that crook was for? To hook any young black sheep that was wandering off to think for herself, right? Now, I make fun of the notion that we all, or the people have in the past worshipped a God who is a shepherd. Can you believe they still say that? In the last, this weekend, today, this Sunday, there are probably several, 20, 30 million Americans who listen to someone in a platform like this saying, "The Lord is my shepherd." Well, no shit, Sherlock. If the Lord is my shepherd, what does that mean I am? Ba, ma, pa. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. See, when we were little babies, baby in arms, you couldn't think for yourself. And like some big, you know, smart ass like me can't bother to think for yourself. Hey, what can you do it? You are a little sheep and a nice cuddly thing. And it's nice to have that period. And when I tell you to, you got to grow out of it. You can't spend grown men and women walking around saying, "Cuddle me, shepherd God." I mean, and I'm not attacking that aspect of us that still hungers. We all hunger for a daddy and a mommy that's going to do all the thinking for us and take care of us. That's healthy. I mean, give into it now and then, you know. Get into a hot tub with your boyfriend or your girlfriend, do it if you want. But anyway, you got to grow up a little bit. Now, the tribal society ended And we moved into a new level of human civilization, as we always do when you change the language and change the technology for packaging thoughts and communicating. You see, the limits of a tribal society, just like the limits of your home, are limited by the sound of the human voice. And the guy that ran the tribe could tell you where to go and when to go, but you were limited to your valley. And in the next valley, there was another guy, another shepherd with another doing the same thing. When they invented writing, that changed the whole situation, and a new dimension of humanity developed. See, when you read and write, you can write those things down and send your people in the galleys across the Mediterranean or camels across the desert, and immediately you've got long-distance communication. And that created the feudal state. It made it wonderfully powerful because the feudal kings and the feudal sultans had the power, that incredibly magic power of reading and writing. Now, we are all concerned today about reading and writing and literacy. Listen, don't kid yourself. Literacy has always been a technique through which the power holders control. See, if I can read and write, and I can write down those little Phoenician shells and the pieces of papyrus, messages, and send them to my agents over in Athens or across in Tunis, and I've got an advantage on you that don't know that. See, writing was originally a code that helped get organizations together over distances. And the reason Johnny can't write is for 4,000 or 5,000 years, they didn't fucking want him to read and write because they'd lose the power. And even today, you know, the slave holders in the Confederacy before our Civil War would not let the slaves read and write. Obviously, why? Because now, when reading and writing started, that changed our concept of religion and changed our concept of human beings. No longer was a human being a little sheep. In the new order of feudalism, there's God, and then there's God's lieutenants on earth. There's the sultan or the king and divine rights kings and all that. And don't worry about reading, about thinking for yourself, boys and girls. It's all being done for you up there in the castle of the duke or the cardinal. They got a big computer up there. It's called an illuminated manuscript. And they got the nerds, the hackers up there. They were monks, you know. They knew the machine language, which is called Latin. They do all the thinking. They'll tell us what you have to do. Now, just as, you know, I'm going to quote you back some of the language of this period. Remember when I talked about we all want a daddy and a mommy God? You know, remember that? Can you believe there's a prayer still used in America? Said, Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Yeah? Thy kingdom come. What? What's this shit about kingdom? Kingdom? Our foremothers and forefathers, was it 10 years ago, came to this country to overthrow kings and royalty and monarch? Get up the fuck out of here, Gord III. And now you're telling me God is a king, his kingdom will come, his will, thy will be done. Yeah? What are you, some fucking mafia capo up there? For thine is the power and the glory. Yeah, I'll get down on my knees, boss. Don't worry about me. Can you believe that shit? Or how about Moses comes down from the mountain, got all the wisdom there, all you need to know, chipped in marble. Can you believe that? See, there's no invitation for word processing. Chipping in marble. Those 10 commandments, they're not 10 suggestions, boys and girls. Okay. No encouragement to take those 10 ideas and bring them to your discussion group. And
Commandment number one.
I mean, we all need principles. We all need algorithms. We need coaching. I mean, I'm not against looking to the past to find navigational hints, but shit, it's not about
Commandment number one. I am the Lord thy God, and thou shalt have no other gods before me.
Well, you can't stand the competition, huh? I mean, insecure bastard.
Thou shalt not make no graven image. Thou shalt not take my name in vain.
Oh, Jesus. Paranoid asshole. I mean,
What?
The Bible.
The Bible is the Word of God. The Bible is written by God. No man or woman dare change it. Well, let's listen to this. Genesis, third chapter. I'm the Lord thy God, and I made everything here. On the first day, I made the stars, and on the second day, I made the heavens and the planets. On the third day, I made the earth. On the fourth day, I made the oceans. And the fifth day, I made the earth and the creepy crawly things. And on the sixth day, boy, I put you, Adam, in this ultimate destination resort. The Garden of Eden. Yeah, I did it. Ultimate Club Mediterranean proprietor, okay? All right, boy. You're my favorite, see? You're a human being, see? Just get down on your knees. As long as you're on your knees, you're my favorite, see? Because you're made in my image. Kind of scary thought. I feel sorry for y'all alone here, so I'm going to take a rib, one of your ribs, and make a woman. She'll be your helpmeet. She'll know her place. She'll follow you around. The Bible is not a women's liberation tract, as you've probably gathered. Now, y'all can do what you want here in the Garden of Eden. Go for it, boy. Just stay here forever. There are just two food and drug regulations. Y'all see that tree over there? That's the tree of eternal life and immortality, life extension, you know, cloning, cryonics. I'm not curious. The fruit of that tree is a controlled substance. Y'all can't eat that because you'll get to be immortal, live like me. You won't be afraid of death and won't have you running scared, and that's going to be bad. And y'all see that tree over there? The fruit of that tree is a controlled substance. That is the tree of knowledge. How isn't that cold-blooded? I mean, how clear can they make it that you are not to touch of the tree of knowledge, lest the blinders fall from your eyes, you begin thinking for yourself. Now, I've always been amused by the fact that they always laid the blame on Eve. It's that naughty, oh, women is terrible, that naughty hip-wiggling Eve that got poor straight arrow Adam and all that trouble. And on the flip side, I think we must, those of us who believe in the title Homo sapiens sapiens, that we are the species that are equipped with this enormous computing machinery, 100 billion neurons up there. Each neuron has the knowledge processing capacity of a big mainframe computer. And it was a woman, Eve, was the first person to get off her knees and stand on her feet, you know, there, try the fruit. The blinds did fall from her eyes. She said, "Hey, Adam, you got to try this." And so the first human being that thought for herself was a woman. And thank God for Eve. Yeah.
You're listening to the Psychedelic Salon, where people are changing their lives one thought at a time.
Thank God for Eve. That seems like a perfect place to take a break for this week, but I promise to play the rest of this talk in my next podcast, and I'm looking forward to hearing the rest of it myself, so I promise that you won't have to wait too long. I did find it interesting to hear Dr. Leary talking about how distressed he was about Abbie Hoffman, particularly his mental state, and he obviously knew what he was talking about because just 5 years later, poor Abbie was found dead after taking a whole bunch of phenobarbital. And depending on who you listen to, it was either a suicide or an accident. Either way, it was a tragic loss for all of us to whom Abbie Hoffman had been an inspiration for so many years. But there was a part of this last talk we just heard that I hope our younger saloners will take another listen to. At around 4 minutes or so into this last piece, where he talks about Abbie being a part of a large group of young people who in the 1960s and 1970s stopped the government in its tracks. And what I suggest you give some thought to is the fact that there is a good chance that your parents or grandparents were part of those times. I realize that most of my idealistic young friends have now grown old in their thinking and have lost the fire that once burned in them. But I'm sure that the spark hasn't died. Personally, almost every one of my friends my age are just like me. We may be quiet and laying low, but you would be amazed at how many psychonauts and psychonaut friendlies there are in this world. We're everywhere. but we have become so cautious, and rightfully so, that it's very difficult to find the others, as Terence McKenna advised. But that seems to be changing now, now that the internet is waking up. So if you're still riding alone out there on the edge of the tribe, well, hang on. Reinforcements are on the way. Can you tell I'm in a good mood today? You know, those talks we just heard were recorded over 15 years ago. One of them even farther back than that. And yet it seems that while everything has changed, nothing is really different. Hopefully we're going to experience something completely different in the years ahead, no matter what the politicians do. But we'll have to wait and see, huh? Well, this has gone on a bit longer than I thought it would, but I still have a couple of short announcements before I go. First of all, I am extremely pleased to report that the project to digitize the Stolaroff and Shulgin papers is well underway. 2 weeks ago, the Shulgins, along with Tanya, Greg, and John Hanna, got together with the Stolaroffs to go through some of Myron's papers, and the upshot of that was John driving home with with about 20 cases of records to sort through and prepare for scanning. And while the team has only just begun this huge project, I think we can all take heart in knowing that this valuable information isn't going to be lost. So my hat is off to the archiving team, and I'll be sure to give you updates as the work progresses. The other archiving project underway is the digitization of some papers that Gary Fisher wrote, but that have never made it to the internet. In a week or so, I'll be sending the papers to one of our fellow Slawners who has a good scanner and OCR software, and he's going to scan them and pass them through the OCR program. Then what will remain to be done is the cleanup work that optical character recognition software requires. And I am very happy to report that we also have enough volunteers to cover that project as well. So our efforts at preserving some of the tribe's history seems to be humming along nicely. Also, I guess I made a mistake last week in saying that my novel is only going to be released as an audiobook because it hasn't been worked on by a professional editor yet. Well, that is true, but it is also true that I already have an editor who I've worked with in the past, and even when I get the money to pay him, I'm still not planning on publishing a paperback edition at any time in the near future. And there are a number of reasons for this, but the main one is that I've been working on this book for over 6 years now, and I simply want to get away from it for a while. So thank you so very much to the dozen or more people who have volunteered to do the edit for me, but for now I think it best just to put that aside for a little while. And plus, I've got to finish recording the audiobook yet, too. On another front, I haven't mentioned the Psychedelic Salon Quarterly lately, but the first edition is shaping up quite nicely. I've seen the titles of some of the submissions, and I'm really looking forward to reading this journal. Once it's online, I'll be announcing it here, of course, but a little website has now been set up to support this effort, and you can find it at psychedelicsalonquarterly.com, and that's all one word. So you might want to check that site from time to time for news about the quarterly, as well as other news from our community. And speaking of our community, I want to remind you about the great podcasts on the Cannabis Podcast Network over at dopefiend.co.uk. There you'll hear BB's Bungalow, hosted by the lovely Black Beauty, whose silken voice you heard at the beginning of this segment. And hers is only one of a group of programs that I listen to regularly over there. In fact, the Dope Fiends weekly podcasts are my primary source of news and information about cannabis. It's a podcast, in my humble opinion, that shouldn't be missed. And then, of course, there's the David Frost of Podcasters, my friend KMO, who I think is one of the best interviewers around. And although he's not on the same network, he's associated with it as I am. And you can find KMO at the Sea Realm podcast. So I'll put links to that up in our program notes. Anyhow, I just want to make sure you're not missing some of those good podcasts over there. And one more thank you I've been remiss in not saying often enough is to the good folks over at the Conversations Network. They're the ones who made their Levelator software available for free. And I've mentioned them before in other podcasts, but I can't thank them enough for providing this valuable podcasting tool. And if you want to see how the Levelator works, in addition to the great information about it on the Conversations Network website, You can also see the Levelator in action in Cody and Sancho's podcasting tutorial on YouTube, which I highly recommend to any of our fellow saloners who are thinking about starting your own podcast. Their tutorial will get you on the fast track to podcasting and without spending much, if any, money. So check that out if you have the bug to add your voice to the global conversation that ultimately is going to do more to make a positive change in the world than all the talking heads and radio and television combined. Well, that's enough for today. So I'll close, as always, by reminding you that this and all of the podcasts from the Psychedelic Salon are freely available for you to use in your own audio projects under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike 3.0 license. And if you have any questions about that, just click the Creative Commons link at the bottom of the Psychedelic Salon webpage, which you can find at psychedelicsalon.org. And that's also where you'll find the program notes for these podcasts. And for now, this is Lorenzo signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Be well, my friends.